So one of the big issues in modern Middle Eastern history writing today is that we just don't have enough social and cultural history. We don't really know how people ate or how farming in 19th century, like say Egypt, worked to quite the level of detail we know of, say, 19th century France. But what if we had, for example, a study of portrait photography to help us fill in the gaps? And what if it tied into greater social issues like modernity, class, modernity being one of the great questions of how to talk about modern Middle Eastern history, and class being this booming area of interest in light of studies of global capitalism. So my name is N.A. Mansour, and welcome to New Books in Middle East Studies. Today we have with us the author of The Arab Imago, A Social History of Indigenous Photography, 1860-1910, out 2016 from Princeton University Press. We have Professor Stephen Shehi, who is the Sultan Qaboos bin Zayed Chair of Middle East Studies and the Director of the Program of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at the College of William & Mary. He is Professor of Arabic Studies as well and holds a joint appointment in AMES and the Arabic Program in the Modern Language Department. He did his doctorate at Michigan, and his work largely examines cultural, intellectual, art history, and the political economy of the late Ottoman Empire and the Arab Renaissance, or al-Nahda al-Arabiya. He is the author of three books. In addition to the book we'll be discussing today, he's written Islamophobia, The Ideological Campaign Against Arabs, out 2011 from Clarity Press, which has been translated into Arabic as Al-Islamophobia, Al-Hamla al-Ideologiya ضد المسلمين, and Foundations of Modern Arab Identity, out 2004 from University Press of Florida. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So we always start off with a bit of a biographical question. What is your intellectual biography? How did you come to the study of the Middle East?
I guess like many other Arab Americans, I came to the study of the Middle East through, political imperative and cultural context, right? I grew up in the United States, and particularly in the 1980s, and a lot of things were happening in Lebanon, and Arab Americans like myself were sort of sitting at home in New Jersey and watching these things transpire in the Middle East, and I just intuitively kind of knew that that there was a disjuncture between sort of discourses that you get via the media at that time, and what might more be going on there was apparent, and it was I'm also a racialized Arab American. Not being white helps not fit in and form identifications with the Middle East. So I went to Temple University. I was sort of an anthropology Mediterranean studies major, and I kind of came to a point in my life where I had a choice to follow sort of one of my true loves, which was archaeology of the Mediterranean and all things Italian and stuff like that. a romantic life of coolness, jumping head first into something that was emotionally and personally important to me politically. So that's kind of what started the journey.
So a lot of your work has engaged with intellectual history, your previous work, previous to this book. But this is a very different book. It's about visual culture. And I think that's very refreshing to see in Middle Eastern history. We don't quite have the level of depth in visual studies that we have in, say, just to use your example, Italian studies. So what was the genesis of this book?
I think this current book in many ways started even with, my dissertation, which was on, in some regards, a separate topic, even though they share the Nahda. So I think it... I have to say that I'm slightly fascinated by the banal and the mundane and the boring. So my first book and my dissertation really focused on, you know, many of these puerile commentaries and short stories and novels or proto novels written in the 19th century that are seen as, you know, pulp fiction and schlock. And that sort of banality, the politics of that banality, the what that banality reproduces and produces, kind of has always informed much of my work. So I think the portrait is a kind of a logical extension, sort of a visual extension of that. So the portrait in many ways is sort of the, I think, an analog to writing practices also of the Nahda. So I think that's its very earliest genesis. And I was always interested in visual culture, even though I wasn't doing it officially in the 1990s, and largely because I think the other work really wasn't done, right? The archival work wasn't done. I feel that, you know, my first book had to be written before the Arab Imago, before the visual stuff, you know, these other sort of ferreting out these discourses and these sorts of epistemological sort of roots had to be defined before I went to something a little more immediate. That which is photography.
No, I really appreciate what you said about the banal, mostly because I think what we forget with the Nahda, sort of this Arabic renaissance of thought, I think the immediate impulse is to assume that, oh, well, it's all about these great ideas, these really big ideas. But I often think that the ideas that change society the most are the ones that we enact in everyday life, and they have the essence of being banal to some extent. But what I also really like about the way you use the word banal, both in what you just said, but also in the book, is that allows us to think about just how photographs, and perhaps before this age, are just things you sort of have around the house. So photography is both a visual medium, but it's also a very physical medium, especially when we think about how photographs are handled. So how do you write about photographs? What was sort of the big shift from writing about ideas and writing about short stories to writing about photographs?
Yeah, that's a great question because, you know, I think, and this slightly has to do with your earlier question, but, and it's sounds kind of pejorative, so I shouldn't say it. But, you know, in the 1990s, you know, everyone in Compilit was sort of doing, everyone discovered film studies, right? Every schmuck who has a PhD in Compilit was going to write an article on some Arab film, right? And I love film, and I love our film. I just felt that accessibility and that sort of immediacy missed something, right? And I think that when I started to write about photography, I realized that we have to write also about the photograph, right? So rather than only the discourses around it, the discourses around film, what this film is sort of producing, what it sort of recalls, but there's also, and this is not to celebrate or over fetishize formalism, but you're really talking about a text that is really this extremely multi-layered intertextual material object. So you kind of have to foreground that. And that's always hard. That was always hard, like when I'm writing, like to sort of, you go riff off and, you know, you can go down the Muqtataf trail or something, but then realize, oh my God, I actually still have to be talking about images. So that's to me, that's the challenge of writing about photography, is rooting yourself in the photograph itself. That's the difference.
So what did source work look like for this project? Sort of where did you get, I mean, I think I should probably describe the book first. Actually, it doesn't look like a typical academic book. It's designed like an art book. It has these beautiful images set in, which I can imagine cost your publisher a lot of money. But yeah, it's gorgeous. But what did the source work look like for this? How did you find the photographs that you used in the text? What additional primary sources you use to supplement the book?
Well, that's always, I mean, to slightly, I don't know if this is answering the question, but or retooling the question, but really the challenge always to me in excavating material culture and social practices of the turn of the century, our world is, you know, what sources do we have, right? And when you have a country like Lebanon that basically went up in flames, when you have Palestine where much of it went up in flames and the other half was stolen and archives are stolen, and how do you talk about quotidian practices and sort of, you know, and objects when there are no, or when there are less accessible, what we can call archival sources or archival sort of wells to dip in. So, and this is kind of how I say that, you know, my first book has always gave me experience in excavating, you know, the journals of the time, which, you know, as you well know, write about everything, and just trying to grab whatever possible source that I can get on, that I get my hands on, whether it's autobiography, whether it is fiction, whether it is poetry, whether it is, you know, travel logs, advertisements, because those, well, I think there might be a particular pitfall to only relying on those sources, which were absent as sources, say 20 years ago, like when I started to work on it, like people weren't working on them as much, and now a lot of people do. So I think obviously the archive forms the topic and the discourses in many ways. But on the other hand, it's kind of all we have. So that's you know, that's kind of what I was doing. I worked on a project, I have to say, for a long time. I mean, I started this project around 2002. And so just, you know, any possible piece of written material that I could get a hold of in addition to the photographs. And then on a not secondary natural, but on a parallel process, is that the images themselves are texts. The images have writing on them. The images have physical scars on them. The images can tell you where they might have been, where they might have come from, but quite often they don't.
No, this is actually, I think, a great part of a great leap forward in the study of the Middle East, is we're starting to think of other things as texts. When we come from a study that has been so grounded in text and intellectual history for so long, for a variety of reasons. So the fact that people are starting to read images and textiles and the environment as text is absolutely phenomenal, and your book will add to that. Another thing that the book is sort of in the midst of is that we're also sort of in this great renaissance of discussions of class in Arabic-speaking societies. And your book, I think, is very much a part of it. You talk a lot about sociability and how images and formalism, which you had mentioned previously, sort of shape portrait photography. So what sort of, I mean, what themes of different forms of sociability and formalism are enacted in portrait photography?
So, you know, again, you know, if we look at, I think a good place to start is to understand the critiques and the previous discussions of class and class subjects, right? And there's this sort of cliche debate that previously was happening between certain academics who they're sort of old timers now, and out of respect, I won't name them, but, you know, about, you know, whether there is a classed subject, whether there is an Arab middle class at the turn of the century, whether there is a bourgeoisie, etc. So for me, just to continue that thought, the photograph was used, the portrait was used by many of these folks to either say, look, people look like bourgeoisie, so they would dress and they would do this, or these are the opposite, rare exceptions, self-selecting data of people who can and would, but of course there are, you know, tens of thousands of other folks who aren't doing it. So the middle class is only very small. And for me, that whole discussion is unfruitful. It doesn't speak to really what I would call the force of social formations, and that are things like, what is it, like identifications with class ideals, which are the sort of the engine for the ideological engine for how economic reproduction happens, right? if you don't identify with capitalism, it's not going to happen. It will be revolution, or it's just, you're just going to have obstinate, you know, workers. So how do we, and that, to me, the photograph facilitates and expresses and enacts at one level these desires, these sort of identifications. So that's the theoretical sort of premise to sociability, right? That is the first material and social act that you have to identify with a class position, and then you actually get the material object of a photograph itself, and then that it becomes currency in its own self, right? And how it's displayed, how it's circulated, people pass it around, people write notes on it, people put it in, you know, hang it on the wall. Yes, you well know from the, so you know, journal. There's discussion about how to make frames for it. How so? It then plays into a series of other social practices that also have to do with identifications of what it means to be a certain classed subject. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Actually, because we're getting more into that aspect of physical, but also you've mentioned banality so many times, and I think this is something worthy of celebrating. Sort of what aspects of banality and formalism sort of combine in portraiture or portrait photography?
What aspects of banality and
formalism?
Well, I mean, I think what fascinates me is the fact that when you look at it, photographs, how much they are repetitive. Right, and they repeat the same image in many ways. And two quick vignettes is, one is I have a friend who's a now very well known visual artist, and when I was starting this project, he was just like, you know, get used to looking at 10,000 of the same images, kind of like trying to shore me up and prepare me to what research is going to look like. And then the other hand is the first time I was giving this talk, one of my talks on photography in a sort of a secular room with it, that is not only Middle Eastern studies people, but people from all over. In many disciplines, and two or three folks came to me and said, "Wow, I'm just really shocked about how these portraits look just like my uncle from Kansas, right?" So that's what fascinated me much, you know, is that you have this sort of formalistic sort of flattening, right? This sort of standardization, but the standardization still has to hold force. Like, why do people do it? What is it communicating? You know, where does it get value? How does this standard currency have value? I don't know if this is answering the question, but so that's one thing. And I think people tend to fetishize how people dress to sort of distinguish between the images. But I think, and they tend to, again, read them like, oh my God, the eyes are looking at the camera, therefore they have agency and or not. And I don't, I mean, that's nice. I think, you know, 30 years ago when you're dealing with postcards, you know, but I think the point for me is that what is it that makes it natural that everyone's standing, looking, and acting in the same way? You know, what is it that gets you there? What is it that gets these subjects there, and why are they doing that? And how did it become not even a question that this is even something bizarre? You know what I mean?
No, absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned it. I mean, that comment about sort of how this looks like my great uncle from Kansas, because I think it sort of ties into one of the implications of studying the Nahda, or the Arabic Renaissance, is that there's this conversation about whether or not Arabic speaking societies are imitating the West. And I think everyone who writes about the Nahda sort of gets caught up in this. And I think, you know, the field has swerved in different directions about what's politically correct or what's fair, what gives agency to the subject. And you use the term indigenous photography in the text. So I was wondering, what are sort of the historiographical and then to some extent the moral implications of using terms like indigenous or imitate or reductive to describe photography in Arabic speaking land?
Right. So I think I try not to use the word, you know, imitate at all. I think, again, that doesn't really it doesn't provide us with anything, right? It ends the conversation. But I use the word indigenous for a number of reasons. You know, Poole has a sort of indigenista sort of discussion as well in Peru of photography and literature, and comes out of literary studies. For me, it was a great shorthand, because when we talk about quote unquote the Arab imago, the history of that quote unquote Arab photography, that is photography not taken by, you know, Europeans and colonialists and Orientalists, it's the concept of Arab. Obviously, we don't want to reify it, and in fact, the people who are participating in photographic production are not necessarily Arab. I mean, who the hell was identifying themselves at that anyway? So, indigenous to me opened up a space where, you know, Jerzy Sabunji, who was this pioneer photographer of Beirut, who lived in Beirut, you know, wasn't born in Beirut. He was probably born in Mardin. His brother, same thing. Who's a sort of funny figure who's traveling all over the place, but in the end, he himself was kind of a photographic pioneer. You have other photographic studios, like by the Kovas, these people who we really don't know much about, but we know much. We know that they really weren't born in, you know, certainly in Lebanon, and probably not even any quote-unquote Arab lands. They were probably born out in eastern, what is now eastern Turkey. And of course, then there's the Armenian connection, where the Armenian participation in photographic production throughout the Ottoman Empire preceded the genocide by a lot. So I think, you know, the term indigenous allowed me to sort of open up a space to one, to make sure that we understand what we're talking about. That is, we're not talking about, you know, Francis Frith, you know, and Orientalist photographers. But we're also not talking about to be a pioneer, quote unquote, of Arab photography, if we can say that. You don't have to be born in, you know, in Zgharta, right?
I'm really glad you brought that up, because I actually think one of the great things about your book is that you treat societies of Arabic speaking lands or Arabic speaking societies, you treat them very holistically. So you definitely get a sense of the diversity within those lands. And again, like you said, sort of what is an Arab? That's one of the things I think all of us working in 19th and 20th century history struggle with. Is it someone who speaks Arabic, which is sort of an easy cop out for someone who does intellectual history? But when you're doing visual culture, that's very difficult. But you really, again, I mean, the Armenians are mentioned. You have the Greek Orthodox. It's really holistic. So I guess this is a broader question, is how do you talk about minorities in the book, and how should we talk about quote unquote minorities in 19th and 20th century Middle Eastern history?
Yeah. Ooh, that's a tough one. I mean, that's another book altogether, right? You know, I my dream book that I'm going to write, you know, in when I retire, is, you know, the people's history of the Maronites, you know, where, you know, I'll be able to bone up more on my Syriac and just, you know, try to get our minds around, you know, what it is to be, you know, a quote unquote minority, which the word is weird, right? I mean, because it holds a lot of implications within an American racial context. It's a really complicated topic that I think I'm probably going to have to cheat to get out of the answer. But I think in terms of photographic production, what I was trying to do, I mean, as much as I'm speaking theoretically about all this stuff, I mean, the book really hopes in some way to have, I don't want to say encyclopedic, but at least a really hard empirical edge to it, right? The reason why this took so long to write is that there has been no comprehensive history of just studios. So just finding those studios, where are they? Trying to find where, you know, where they're based, if there were, you know, and it's very hard. It's a very hard trajectory to sort of to find. What was common in most of these studios is that most were not Muslim, but I know that Muslims did engage in photographic practice, whether as photographers or as consumers. So it's a very fine line to try to talk about photography because in context of minorities, because the way it has previously been talked about is, oh yeah, photography was practiced by Christians and Armenians, and that's because they could, because they're closer to Europeans, because they've historically had these relationships with Europeans, and because Christians and Christian Arabs and Armenians somehow, because they're Christians, have a propensity towards Western practices more easily than their Muslim and Jewish counterparts. And that's a real problem for me, you know what I mean? Because even though I can't necessarily track the number of Muslim-owned studios before 1920 as easily, that doesn't necessarily mean, by all means, that Muslims weren't largely participated in photographic practices. Does that kind of... I guess what I'm trying to do is explain the challenge more than give you an answer.
No, absolutely. I think another problem that you alluded to is that there is this assumption. I mean, walk into any museum, one of these holistic museums in the Western Hemisphere, the British Museum or the Metropolitan Museum of Art, you walk in and in the Islamic wing, there's always a sign that says, oh, well, the Arabs or the Muslims, they don't like visual culture because of this and this stipulation in Islamic law. Thus, they like calligraphy and geometric shapes. And I'm just like, no, there are many. I mean, any art historian can tell you of just sort of all of the, in addition to the wonderful calligraphy and all the plays with geometry, there are wonderful images of humanoid figures and
figurative
animals.
Right, figurative so, representations. And I think, but this is the problem, right? I mean, I think at one level, what we don't want to do is underplay the actual fact, the historic fact, and the social fact that minorities did find photography a place where they could eke out a living, and they could find, and I think that, for example, and I can't really speak too much of Armenian photography because I really don't have the language skills, which I certainly wish I did, because I know there's a lot of information and a lot of resources. Unlike the Armenians actually have tons of stuff on this, but you just have to read Armenian, which I don't. But for example, I think Armenianness plays into it's not irrelevant that the Armenians practice photography and ended up actually being a very, very well represented in photography. And part of that is that their minority status created communities in which they could do that, right? So I don't want to make it irrelevant that minorities were overrepresented in photographic production. I think their minority, the social fact of their minority communities as being tightly organized, and you know that they have their own transnational and local social connections, help them establish themselves as photographers. I think that is not irrelevant. In other words, there is an interplay between their social status and their social milieu and their as minorities, and that they're photographers. However, on the other hand, we don't want that to become a deflection of photography being a mass practice. The fact that photography is a mass practice, the fact that the photograph is a quote unquote secular practice, precisely speaks to this moment in history, right? That everyone is engaged in producing a quote unquote secular culture. Right? That's not coincidental. And of course, that is also, it is not coincidental that this practice is championed by the Sultan himself, a number of sultans, right? So while I'm careful with using this word secular, I think it's really important to understand the relationship between photography and secular social and political practices, which is what was happening at the time in many ways. The empire was becoming secularized. And I don't just mean that in terms of taking religion out of state governance, but I mean that in terms of social practices are themselves becoming disenchanted in a sort of Durkheimian sense.
I'm glad you sort of brought us up to the empire level, because that's going to be my next question, is that I think part of the book's argument is to orient two intellectual and cultural movements vis-a-vis one another. So one of them being, of course, the much aforementioned Nahda, the Arabic intellectual renaissance, and then also Ottomanism, which has many different connotations and definitions. So sort of how did you see the relationship between the Nahda and Ottomanism or Osmanlılık?
I think, you know, obviously what... if I can call it Nahda studies, what Nahda studies of the past 20 years has kind of done, and this can be in literary studies or in historical studies, is that previously the Nahda is seen as effectively the quote-unquote roots of Arab nationalism, and Arab nationalism is exclusivist and therefore in antagonism with Ottomanism, because Ottomanism, therefore, within that sort of, you know, nationalist sort of paradigm, is also seen as proto-Turkism, right, or Turkish nationalism. And what Nahda studies has kind of done is quite the contrary. Like late Ottoman, what has happened in late Ottoman studies over the past 20 or 30 years is that shows that these are interlinking projects. There is no Nahda. So when you without the Tanzimat, right? The language of the Nahda is the language of the Tanzimat, and the Tanzimat starts quote unquote before the Nahda or at the same time as the Nahda, and it comes and there's a, you know, people in Beirut aren't just hanging out, and just because there's no telephones to Istanbul doesn't mean that there's no interaction between the two. Anybody who knows any sort of political history realizes that the social, educational, military, and political interaction between Istanbul, what was happening in Istanbul, and what's happening in the Arab provinces. So the Nahda is, we can say, an outgrowth or a counterpart, the Arab counterpart to Ottomanism, to late Ottomanism. And while that changes, that project changes before World War I, I think that definitely the esprit de corps of the Tanzimat is very, very similar and intertwined with the Nahda.
Yeah, I think people often neglect to mention how many of these Nahda figures were intertwined with different aspects of even Ottoman diplomacy and statecraft, like Sattar al-Husri, who, you know, has this very, is very much an Ottomanist before 1918.
His parents are, I mean, they're Ottoman apparatchiks.
Yeah. And he's dragged around the empire. And apparently, according to legend, spoke Turkish much better than he did Arabic, which he then mastered at a very late stage in his life, and then is important to Syrian nationalism during the Mandate period. And the figures like him, there's the Khalidis from Palestine. So there is this intertwinedness. One of my favorite archival finds recently was I was reading through the letters of Jujri Zeydan, and he's going on and on and on about how he should have learned Turkish when he was younger, and he was learning at a much later stage. He was also apparently deluded about how quickly it would take him to learn Turkish. He assumed it'd take him a month of an hour of study a day, which is not the case with, I think, anyone who studied Turkish.
I think this is an important point that you raise, and that is we don't only have to look at those folks who actually hurt, you know, the big, you know, folks who were, you know, Walis and, you know, whatever. But we can also look at, quote unquote, the sort of the grassroots folks. And if you look at someone like, you know, Sabunji, Jurji Sabunji, who was a straight up photographer, and he had a photographic studio, and it seems to be pretty successful. At the same time, he was working with the municipality, and he had, you know, if you have, you see photographs of any of these folks, any Nahdlawi sort of figure, they always have some sort of medal. Those are Ottoman medals, right? When you see someone in a uniform, that's an Ottoman uniform. That's a given as a form of recognition. You know, the chevrons that they have, these are all official Ottoman practices. And so you don't necessarily have to be Louis Sabunji, his brother, who was kind of a Nasab, who was, you know, picking sides, all these things, but like Ahmed Sidya, end up in Istanbul actually working for the Sultan, both Sidya and Louis Sabunji. You don't necessarily have to be that. I mean, we don't even have to track to that sort of social practice. It's the people on the ground, we can see the relationship and between what it looks like to live at the municipal level and how closely the Ottoman sort of presence is in terms, you know, with juridically or whatever. And of course, you know, that's where social histories like Jens Hansen's book about Beirut and all are really, really important. You know, they really do show that closeness.
So, to switch gears for a moment, what does portraiture look like institutionally? What does it look like if I'm a 19th century, as you said, Nahdlawi, and I want to go get a portrait commissioned? Or what if I'm in a group setting? Sort of how do I commission a picture for a group of people out of, I don't know, a certain school?
Yeah, I think I don't know if commission sounds a little bit grandiose. It sounds a little bit painterly. I think, you know, I mean, while we don't have any, business ledgers of any studios or anything like that, I think we work from the mounts that they have, right? That you have someone's name, and then next to the name, they'll usually have like where the studio is. And sometimes you have one name, and it'll be in a couple of different localities. Sometimes you have, so the Kirkorians are in Jerusalem, and Sabunji is in Beirut, but sometimes you'll have a picture, a photograph that says Kirkorian Sabunji, and it'll say Jaffa on it, you know? So what I would deduce from this is that you basically have, you know, photographic shops. People walk in and for a pretty decent price get their picture taken. And that's a sort of standard practice. And then it's produced and they're given a number of different, portraits. I think that on an institutional level, I didn't really work on group portraits, and I think that's a whole nother world. But it's a very interesting question. A lot of places had, for example, schools, for example, had in-house ateliers. So the Jesuits absolutely did. But what is important for us is to see, like, all the institutions that were being born in the 19th and early 20th century, all of them felt it important enough that they had to have their portraits taken as institutions. And they organized them, they visually organized themselves to parallel how they organized themselves institutionally. So again, we look at this like, oh yeah, of course they would. But why should we actually look at it as something natural? To me, I would think about why is it important that some kuliyye would have a faculty portrait, right? How is that? Can we denaturalize that in some way? And I think that's what's an interesting sort of line to follow inquiry about. But in terms of further, how does that look? I think it looks in a different ways. I think some people had in-house ateliers. Some people would just go to the local photographer and say, hey, can you come over? I think I'm kind of more fascinated personally about how that actually happens so seamlessly and naturally. And kind of, even though we should think about maybe denaturalizing that.
So one thing I enjoyed about the book was how you engage with all of these different theoretical frameworks. And we've alluded to many of them already in this interview over the course of it. We've broken down quite a few of those. But in particular, what I think is really interesting is that you allude to and take inspiration from the subaltern school. So how applicable did you find that the subaltern school and its theoretical frameworks, how applicable do you find it to Middle Eastern studies and to the visual culture of Middle Eastern history in particular?
I wouldn't identify my work as something that is that is a work on subaltern study in a work on subaltern studies. This is not to say that subaltern theorists don't inform me in some way. And certainly Gramsci does inform me, and I think Gramsci is someone that demands us to be to reread. But I think subaltern studies is it's very complicated, and I think it's also misused in many ways. But I will say, in as much as my own work, I don't think it's necessarily about the subaltern. And the subaltern, I think my work sometimes might give a chapeau bas to subaltern studies, in as much as how we want to use the image as a historical text, and what does the photograph actually tell us. And this is where I think through the photograph as multi-layered, and at one level it enacts certain discourses, but on the other layer that there's a latent context to the image itself. And that latent context is that which is unrepresentable, the things that have been pushed out. And in that regard, it's the subaltern. It has a sort of a nod to subaltern studies, because the nod to subaltern studies is not just about working class. That's not necessarily what this subaltern studies is about, trying to find ways of represent those people who are locked out of representation, kulliyan. You follow what I'm saying? So I wouldn't necessarily identify my work as within subaltern studies, although I certainly do appreciate, you know, those foundational works in it.
Now, and you're very nuanced about that in the book, sort of referring back to it and then sort of referring back to the theories in whole and then taking what you can from it, and saying where it's applicable and where it's not. So I wanted to ask you, because again, books like this are so rare. Studies of visual culture are just so far and few between in Middle Eastern history and historical studies. Where do you see the field of, do you think the field is opening up to visual culture?
Yeah, I think as you noted, there's definitely a movement to, there's a return to the materiality of history. I think that we were pushed into a dichotomous world by the late 90s, where there was a false understanding or false dichotomy between sort of Foucault and Marx, right? And so it was all about discourse, or it's all about materialism. And I think that there's a return to materialism without necessarily surrendering the force of discourse. So I think that that's a trend in general. I think that visual culture and sort of material objects are becoming, as you noted, recentered as objects that we can try to think about. And this comes out of a lot of, you know, theoretical stuff that's going on, and, you know, Latour and all these, and Rancière and all these sorts of folks, where objects have living histories. So I think there's a lot. I in photography studies, there's definitely a renaissance or a renewed interest in it in a critical way too. Yeah, I think that's definitely where we're heading towards. And I will only end in this point, is that what I like about it is that people are actually, you know, 20 years ago, people either did theory or they did hardcore empirical history. And now I think we're at a stage where we do have a generation of scholars who can handle both responsibly and adeptly, which is allowing us to move to a place where we can think about materiality, but also think about it, theoretically.
Yeah, and I think a lot of this has been informed by the fact that we're in a bit of an, well, not a bit of, we're in a full-blown archives crisis right now, which is, of course, very, very, very secondary to what's going on in the Middle East currently. I think sort of the concerns of historians and preserving history is little compared to the fact that there are these mass human tragedies going on. But as people who have to make their living off of writing history and using archival sources is something we think about. And we have to be very creative with what we look for. We have to think about, well, I mean, if I can't access this source because it's in Damascus, where can I go and find it?
And I think actually, but just as to kind of expand on that thought and also kind of answer the previous question, which is, the global and regional and local limitations that academics are put into thrust us to rethink how objects circulate and humans circulate and human histories, right? And it can be very productive. And I mean, as horrible as I think, so I'm not like, thank God there was a Syrian crisis, you know, Syrian civil war. I'm not saying that, but, you know, obviously. But I'm saying it's those are not two separate. The predicament of the of academics and how they're dealing with that is not necessarily separate from the material conditions that force them to find new ways to think about things. And so, for example, it's forcing us to, for example, think about things like afterlives, right? So, in other words, you think about the Nahda, you think about images, for example, think about portraits. Okay, when we look at a portrait from the 19th century, that had a particular currency determined by the market, determined by the of exchange that it was being exchanged in, right? But that image now also has a different sort of currency. The image itself has taken on a number of different afterlives, which are themselves imbricated with the history of that image and the history of that representation, but on the other hand, with the current moment. So I think actually the crises that we have now going on in the Middle East and how academics have to do historical work are not necessarily, they don't sit side by side, but they're interlinked about the new methodologies that we have to think about to get at certain historical questions.
Yeah, and we've talked a lot about agency, and I think repurposing sources and thinking again, like you said, about how things get to different places, or reconsidering different historical cases will hopefully allow us to give further agency to our historical subjects. That's always the hope. Yeah. So anyway, thank you so much for this interview.
My pleasure.
The book is phenomenal and gorgeous, and I hope that people appreciate it for what it's adding to the field.
That's very kind of you. Thank you.
So to close the interview, we always sort of ask, what are you working on currently? Can you give us any teasers?
I'm working on two or three projects. One, I'm finishing a book with Salim Tamari and Isam Nassad that's going to be published by the University of California Press. And it's about the photographic albums of Wasif Jawhariya. And so that's becoming, we're finishing that right now. And Bishara, that's going to be appearing in Bishara Dumani's Palestine, New Directions for Palestinian Studies series. I'm also working on a larger sort of an extension of this project on photography called Decolonizing Photography, which is trying to search for a methodology of how we can approach image production in our context in the Middle East, but in the sort of colonized context. So, and also, with my wife, I am co-writing a book called Psychoanalysis Under Occupation, where we look at sort of both the psychoanalytic effects of occupation, but also really practices by which Palestinians have instituted to stave off what we call psychological sort of intrusion. In other words, kind of how do you stay sane under occupation? So that's the other project we're working on.
Well, those all sound like phenomenally fruitful projects, and I think they're going to add a lot to the field.
Thank you.
Anyway, thank you for the interview.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.